Blog Talk Radio.
Guru, you're losing interest in me, and it shows. It ain't no big thing, but it's growing. The pain of heartbreak I've just started knowing. Well, it ain't no big thing, but it's growing. Every day the hurt grows bigger than before. But I'll pretend I don't know this. If I can hold you one day more, you've got the look of someone who is going. You're gonna leave me, and it's showing. A little tear I can feel start to flow. It ain't no big thing, but it's growing. I don't know this, but if I can hold you one day more, you got the look of someone who is going. Well, you're gonna leave me, and it's showing. A little tear I can feel start to flow. Well, it ain't no big thing, but it's growing. No, it ain't no big thing, but it's growing.
All right. Hello, all my Elvis book reading friends. How are you doing tonight? I hope you're doing well. Tonight we're starting a new book, Baby Let's Play House by Elena Nash. And we're going to be reading the first chapter and see what the book is all about. Granted, I know that it's probably about Elvis and his love life. And I know that's why you ladies are joining me this evening, because it's always the rage to find out what really happened behind closed doors. And if not, it's okay, because there's other things in this book, too, besides what happened behind closed doors. Lots of other things happened, too. I mean, it's not just about Elvis and his women. There's some other things in here, I'm sure. So I'm not going to make assumptions what's in here, because I've never read it before. Our special guy has never read it before. I have been waiting over a year to read this book, and Elena Nash has been waiting on the sidelines for us to get this book going so she can be on the show. So that will be really great. Not every day we get an author to come on to talk about the book that we're reading. So it will be amazing. And hello, all my friends out there in the world. And hello, all my friends in the Elvis Book Club chat room. Hello, hello, hello. Anyways, we are doing this different tonight. I had to do it on the TLC network, our sister station, because the TCB network is not working right now. We've got technical difficulties, so I had to borrow Jenny's network in order to do this show tonight, and I'm very appreciative that she let me, and I'm glad you guys are here. So let me read my legal disclaimer, and I could say hello to my first call guest before we begin, and I'm just going to let you know I've had a really rough day. I've been trying to get everything done to leave for a whole month. And, you know, this week is very busy for me. And this is the last week of Wade's school. So, yeah, it's another thing. If you want to call in, the number is 516-387-1332. Okay? All right. My legal disclaimer, I want everyone listening to know what I'm about to say is based upon my personal opinion and beliefs and not the opinion and beliefs of others. This show is for y'all to make up your own conclusions. My 34 years of research has brought me to my conclusions. This show is to help y'all make up your own mind. But here at the TCB Network, we believe Elvis is alive. We do. It's just a little thing, but it's a big thing to us. It really is. And these shows have nothing to do with that. These shows are just a book club where we read an Elvis book and we tell you our opinion on the book. That's pretty much it. And then we talk about the book. Anyways, if you have any problem with anything on this show, or somebody pee-peed in your Cheerios, or your cornbread didn't turn out good, or something stupid like that, just let me know and I'll get you in contact with my lawyer and you can talk to him about it, okay? Also, the graphics are usually made by Tanya, but they're not in this episode. I didn't really ask her this week to make anything. She's been, you know, really sick and down, and I don't want to bother her at this time. Anyways, but they are usually made by Miss Tanya, but not this evening, they're not. Anyways, let me see who we got here. We've got Sue and Rhonda and Anne. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
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 Hello. What you guys laughing at? I didn't even say anything yet.
Well, it was the way you said hello, I guess.
I was like, goodness sakes. Anyways.
I think people laugh at you, too. Just like Elvis moving one leg and everybody going nuts.
Oh, I get laughed at enough around here. I know it. I know it for a fact. I do. But, guys, as I said tonight, we're going to be starting this new book, and I do have the opinion of our special guy of the last, very last few pages of Elvis What Happened, so I can tell you about what he felt like about the whole book in general, and then we'll start this book. But we do have our special guy's opinion about last week's last chapter of Elvis What Happened, so we have that.
Oh, good.
Always look forward to that.
Mm.
Yes, that's one of the best parts.
I didn't say it. I didn't say it.
No, you didn't say it, but we were all faking it, honey, so it's okay. All right. So, as I said, I got to get organized. People, I got a trip to take in less than, like, 7 days. I've got to get everything organized. It's going to be hard, but I'm going to try and be as organized as I can and keep these shows going, even though I'll be on vacation. I will tell you that there might be a few days that I might not make it, okay? But it'll be okay. It's my vacation. I'm allowed. But I will try to make as many as I can, but sometimes I might have to miss one or two, and I can't help that. I'll be with family and can't really schedule stuff when you're with family. You know, so I'll do my best. But our special guy is not looking forward to this book whatsoever. He's read all the reviews on this book, and he didn't like what he was hearing. So I told him that this is going to be one of those tester outer books. We're going to test it, and if y'all don't like it, then we can stop. Of course, I'll read it on my own by myself, but if y'all don't want to listen to it anymore, all you have to do is tell me, you know, we'll start another book. It's kind of like a temporary thing. If you guys like it, let me know. If you guys don't like it, let me know. I'm going to see which ones don't like it and add it all up. And if we don't like it, then we might have to start another book. We'll see. I don't really want to say that because I am really good friends with Elena Nash, and I wouldn't want to tell her, you know, how many people dislike your book. But we'll just see what happens, okay?
Okay.
Test out the waters a little bit.
Hmm.
Yep. I mean, normally I don't like to do this, but like I said, I mean, some of the reviews on this book have been a little iffy. So if anything, we'll see what happens. Now, today is Priscilla Presley's birthday, and I just want to give out a shout-out to Miss Prissy Pants. May she forever, may she forever make money off of Elvis's name. Mwah, mwah. Poor little rich girl. Happy birthday. All right. That's all I wanted to say about that. I've been wanting to say that on air all day. All day. I think I already said it once on Greg's post, but I was like, I had to say it on air. So happy birthday, Prissy Pants. But anyway.
Prissy Presley.
No, Prissy Pants, honey. No. Prissy Pants. PP. Or you can call her PP. I do that too sometimes. Miss PP. But anyways, I am glad that Miss Sue, Rhonda, and Ann have called in. If you guys want to call in, it's 516-387-1332. And we can't talk too long because we've got reading to do. But how are you, Miss Sue?
I'm doing good.
Good. You sound good.
Thank you. You do too. Even though you've had a long day, I understand. I have too. I fell asleep on Jenny's show Sunday.
It happened.
I'm not going to do that tonight. I'm sitting up.
All right. Well, it happens. It happens. If I try to fall asleep tonight, just yell at me, guys. Snap your fingers. I'll wake up. I promise, even though I'm the one reading it.
Okay.
I can't wait till this week is over. Ugh. Just can't. But thank you, Miss Steve, for calling. We'll make sure that you stay awake, honey. Okay. I promise.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Miss Rhonda, how are you this evening?
I'm wonderful, Shauna. I'm wonderful.
Good.
So
good.
To everybody.
Well, hello to you too. Hey.
So anyway, I'm anxious to start this book and
good.
I'm gonna see what voices you're gonna do with all these different characters, and it's gonna be interesting, I think.
Oh,
Rhonda,
yeah.
She had read it.
Yeah, you're right. There's so many different characters in this book. I hope that I don't develop a multiple personality disorder.
I'll try
and be real careful with that. I won't be a method actor. I promise. Okay.
We don't want you to develop split personality, Shauna.
Well, hell, if you guys are going to order my straight jacket, just make sure it's purple and sequins, and I'll be fine. Okay. All right.
With a lightning bolt. How about that?
Even better. Miss Ann, how are you today? And happy birthday to your son.
Thank you very much, Shauna. I'm wide awake, and I'm great.
Good. You sound wide awake. Man, you're this wide awake at 1 something in the morning, girl. I want whatever you're having. Give me whatever you're having.
No kidding.
Is there something special in your tea?
No. A drop of milk. That's it.
Woo. Goodness sake. I'm trying to stay awake myself. Like I said, I've had a really busy day, but we're going to get through this, I promise. With a smile on our face, we'll do this.
Definitely.
Anyways, I'm gonna play a song, guys, to get us in the mood, and then I'm gonna say our special guy's opinion about the last few pages of Elvis What Happened, okay?
Okay, great.
And thank God this studio is a lot cleaner than my other. Oh, Lordy. Don't even want to go there. Oh, goodness. Okay, this will wake us up. This is I Wash My Hands in Muddy Water.
I was born in Macon, Georgia. They kept my daddy, in the Macon jail. He told me, if you keep your hands clean, yeah, you won't hear them bloodhounds on your trail. Well, I fell in with bad companions. Robbed a man, up in Tennessee. They caught me
you do, son?
I wash my hands in muddy water. Wash my hands, oh, but they didn't come clean. Try to do like my daddy told me, yeah. But I must have washed my hands in a muddy stream. Well, I asked the judge, now when's my time? He said, son, oh, you know we won't forget. Now, if you try just to keep your hands clean, yeah, we might just make a good man of you. Well, I couldn't wait till to get my time. I broke out of national jail. I just crossed state line of Georgia. Yeah, well, I can't hear them bloodhounds on my trail.
What you doing?
Wash my hands in muddy water. I wash my hands, oh, but they didn't come clean. Tried to do, had to do like my daddy told me, yeah. But I must have washed my hands in a muddy stream. Yeah, I wash my hands in muddy water. I wash my hands, oh, but they didn't come clean. Tried to do like my daddy told me. But I must have washed my hands in muddy water. Yeah, wash my hands in muddy water. I wash my hands, oh, but they didn't come clean. I tried to do like my daddy told me. Oh yeah, but I must have washed my hands in muddy water. Yeah, I wash my hands. Wash my hands, oh, but they didn't come clean. I tried to do like my daddy told me, oh, yeah. But I must have washed my hands in a muddy stream.
Yeah, now you're talking business. Have a chair, man. Not every day you get a wife given to you. Anyways, okay. So here is our special guy's opinion about the last few pages of Elvis, What Happened, okay? That wasn't the whole telephone conversation between me and Red West. It lasted something like 57 minutes and might be on YouTube still, but it's also on CD. But the way you read it, it went down like that. It's too stupid to say they wrote that book to wake me up because they cared for me. Written by two of the men who were themselves into street drugs. It was written out of revenge and to make money. They don't admit that they were beating up fans and I was getting sued for it. In such cases, psychiatrists get involved by the victim's lawyers. One victim had both kneecaps shattered and sued for $1 million. I managed to settle out of court for $100,000 while another two such cases were going on. Sonny and Red just didn't care, so I agreed with psychiatrists being called in. Couple all that with $1.3 million being asked for the racquetball courts I was supposed to be in by name only. Anyway, I knew I was leaving soon, so they could write their damn book. I wasn't going to kill myself over it. Sonny loved me? You must be kidding. Sonny was there for the money. He betrayed me in a way that's unforgivable and unexcusable. He's the ultimate traitor. Judas could learn something from him. But I forgive him. He said, I changed after I started using cocaine. I never, ever was stupid enough to use cocaine. He was the biggest backstabber of all of them, and proud of it, too. He told the world that Steve Dunleavy, who ghost wrote Elvis What Happened, his words. Why did he defend the book then? Why did he agree to reprint 2 million copies by August 18th, the day of the funeral? Then for years afterwards, he told the world that he loved me. Then why did he answer out of revenge? When the reporters asked him why he wrote the book, yes, that was his very first answer. He only thought of the pathetic we wanted to wake him up excuse. Now he remembered the fun times. So why did he send me in 1976 the message that I was finished? Good golly, this guy is the real devil in disguise. He's the ultimate disgrace to the Elvis world. As for me ever being racial, I used to often visit Culpepper's Chicken Shack and Coronado Street in Memphis in the 50s. It was well known for its tasty barbecue chicken and best service made restaurant, a favorite of BL Street entertainers and patrons for decades. I was one of many young white men who ate at Culpepper's. At any given time, Culpepper's, one might see men in their working clothes sitting next to a couple in a tuxedo and evening gown. One never knew what celebrity might walk into Culpepper's. Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King were regulars. What appealed to visitors alike is that Mr. Culpepper always treated everyone the same, regardless of their dress or position in life. I felt this way, too. Once someone asked me why I referred to Mr. Culpepper as a black man as Mr., and I replied, I've been calling him Mr. all along. Why would I change it now? That was his opinion. All right, Sue and Rhonda and Ann, let's go down the list here. We'll go the other way now. Miss Ann, what did you think of his opinion?
Well, to be quite honest with you, Shona, I was not surprised, really, because, I mean, Elvis forgiven for doing that book. It just shows you what sort of man he is. He doesn't hold grudges or anything. I don't know how people can do what they do to him. I really don't.
Well, it is kind of strange during that interview when the book first came out that he said the first thing he said was to help him, and the second thing he said was out of revenge.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Yeah,
there
was
the truth right there.
Yeah, it was. Definitely.
Yeah. And Miss Susan was like, there wasn't a racist bone in his body. Well, of course there wasn't. I don't trust anybody who says Elvis is racist because he didn't show it in any way, shape, or form in any of the things that he ever did in his career, even before his career.
That's right.
He would treat the janitor the same way as he would treat a CEO of RCA Records. It's always sir and always ma'am. Didn't matter what color your skin are or what street you were raised on.
And if there's any truth in it, I remember reading that Elvis bought a colored lady a car, if I remember rightly.
And he also bought a colored, well, we'll call them African-Americans because that's politically correct, but he also bought one a high-class wheelchair because he heard that she couldn't get around.
There you go. This is what he's all about.
You know, and come on, the Sweet Inspirations. What kind of group was that, ladies and gents? If he didn't like black people, he wouldn't have had them on stage with him. It's true.
Elvis loves them all. Any color, race, any nationality, the lot. He loves them all. He's got no racism in him at all.
Well, thank you, Miss Ann, for your opinion.
Thank you, Shona.
You're welcome. Miss Rhonda, help me, Rhonda. What's your opinion?
Well, I just about busted a gut when he said that Judas could have learned a few things from Sonny.
You know, he didn't tell me. You know what? He said that he did something so unforgivable. Do you think the rumor is true? Do you think that the rumor of Sonny getting it on with Priscilla really happened? Why would our special guy say that what he did, he's not going to tell us, but it was so unforgivable. Huh. I don't know. It makes you wonder. Makes you.
I have no idea, but I don't know. But I tell you what, he did forgive them, which is good for him. I mean, because, you know, if you carry around all that anger, it's, forgiveness isn't just for the person you're forgiving. It's also for yourself. So
it's for you to heal and get over it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I know what you're
exactly.
saying.
And so I'm glad that he was able to do that because it was good for him as well for his soul to heal. So, but I did find that statement hilarious that he made.
Yeah, I just find it kind of intriguing how our special guy said whatever Sonny did, he will not tell us, but it was so unforgivable. It was just so hard to forgive for that. So it makes me wonder, what was it?
Wonder what it could have been.
I don't know, but I read an insert in a book once, and I can't remember what book it was, but it mentioned something about Priscilla going through the gates, and some fans saw Sonny hunched down in the back of her car. And I always wondered about that.
Really?
I was thinking to myself when I was reading the insert, and I'll find it eventually and tell you guys. I don't know what book it was. I just know I was reading an insert, and it said that the fans saw Priscilla going through the gates, and Sonny was hunched over in her car hiding, and they saw him. But what's funny is if what he was doing was wrong, then, yeah, I can see him hiding. But if what he was doing was right, then why was he hiding? Why would you have to hide?
They were all friends and part of that entourage, so why would he be hiding? That
he was hunched down in the floorboard of her car, so when she passed, all you could see was her face, but the fans in the back saw Sonny hunched down in the floorboard. So I'm thinking, why hunch? Don't get it. I always wondered about that.
Yeah.
Just like I always wondered, I can't prove this, but I always wondered if Jerry Schilling had a little bit of piece of the action, too. I always had that.
Oh,
feeling.
I wonder if he feels that.
Yeah, to this day. I mean, they still go out to lunch. It could be a little booty call here and there. Who knows? Who knows?
I mean, they travel together. They do boat tours together. They do books.
They're the same age. There's only a couple of years between them.
He's always usually at the Graceland stuff with her, you know.
He's always handsy around her. His arm is always around her.
I know, there's something about him that.
Something about him. I'm not saying for truth or anything. I'm just saying opinion. I just think something went on.
Yeah, it's kind of curious to me. I'm just really curious about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Miss Rhonda, for your opinion.
You're welcome.
Well, Miss Susan said her opinion is she agrees with everything that he said because she thought the same. And that she also said that she believes that he was jealous of him. Well, lots of men were jealous of Elvis. I mean, come on. Lots of men. Maybe because all the women wanted to be with Elvis and all the men were pissed off because their women want to be with Elvis and not them. Hey, that's something to be jealous about, I guess. But thank you, Miss Susan, for your opinion. Miss Sue, what's your opinion?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm glad that it finally ended because it needed to, because with all the fights going on and all the lawsuits, was certainly not making Elvis look good. And so it had to come to an end. It just had to.
I had no idea that they shattered a fan's kneecaps. Wow. Talk about aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what could a fan do so bad that would warrant their kneecaps to be shattered? I don't understand.
Mm-mm-mm. Well,
you know,
there's
what took place with them
on drugs and trying to, you know, play Mr. Tough Guys and all and trying to protect me, of course, too. And, you know, just,
I think,
it just turned into an uncomfortable situation for Elvis and for Vernon as well, because, you know, he was the one that was having to back the money and put up everything for the trials. And he was very fortunate that he wasn't sued really big.
Yeah, he got lucky throughout his life about that. There's a lot of lawsuits that could have went in for a lot more than they did. He got lucky on the settlements on some of them. But I will say one thing. You're right. The Memphis Mafia got so hard, swollen heads that they put the Mafia theme in their heads so much it made them cocky. They thought they were actually some type of Mafia towards the end,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing what they felt
right.
like they could do. But, I mean, mm-hmm. I would say shattering somebody's kneecaps was pretty extreme.
And there's probably a lot of things that took place that he never knew about.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. But he wasn't mm-hmm. as stupid as some of these guys in his employment thought he was. He had people telling him stuff. He had people telling him things that was going on. He had people telling him. How do you think he found out that Joe Esposito was the colonel's spy? Somebody told him? A little birdie?
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, thank you, Miss Sue, for your opinion. And I think we're going to start reading this book, get some, you know, pages in. I'm going to play one song to get us in the mood, and I'll be back with the book, okay?
Okay.
All righty then. Here we go. This is Gentle on My Mind.
It's knowing that your door is always open down your path. Now that makes me tend to keep my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch. It's knowing I'm not shackled by forgotten words and bonds. I have the heat stains that have dried up on some love. That keeps you in the back roads or by the rivers of my memory. It keeps you rivered gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on their columns, but or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be hurt or forgiven when I walk along some railroad track and that you're moving on the back road by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you just tickle on my mind. Though the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyard and the highways come between us, and some other woman's crying to her mother cause she turned and I was gone. I still might rot in silence until the shore might stain my face, and the summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you walking in the back roads by the rivers are flowing gentle on my mind. I dip my cup of soup back from a curtain in the frying cauldron in some graveyard. My beard erupts in cold hard and a dirty hat pulled low across my face. Cupped hands around the tin can, I pretend to hold it to my wrist and find that you're waving from the back road by the rivers of my memory, ever smiling, never kissing on my mind.
All right, guys. This is Baby, Let's Play House. And the first page says, for Rockin' Robin' Rosian, Queen of All Elvisness, TCB. All right. Here we go. Chapter 1, My Best Gal. Gladys. In rock and roll mythology, she is the proud, all-suffering Madonna. The commoner who birthed a king and died too soon, knocking his world off its axis. Like her famous son, her first name is all that is needed, Gladys. Elvis called her my best gal. But in the deepest psychological sense, she was not only his best gal, but also his only one. In the well-known images from the late 50s, she appears a defeated figure, her eyes sad and ringed by bruised circles, her mouth perpetually turned down and set in a sorrowful skull. At the height of her son's notoriety, when she was in Graceland, the home and farm Elvis bought for her, surrounded by the kind and luxury she had never really wanted and rarely enjoyed, she spent her days, as she always had, dipping snuff, drinking beer from a paper sack, staring out the window, and for a short time, until Elvis's record company complained it wasn't seemly to feed her chickens out back, the hot-tempered woman who had been known to dump a pot of steaming beans on her husband's head when he crossed her was now a fearful soul, afraid of Elvis's safety, always worried about a wreck or me getting sick, Elvis would say. The way the women molded at him at his shows and worse, how his stratospheric career had changed everything so fast. Wretchingly pulling him away from her and from everything they had always known. As if to reverse it all and find some comfort, she made monthly visits to the area surrounding the small town of Tupelo, Mississippi, where she had grown up. Earlier on in her life, she had been an outgoing girl, a happy, joking person with a lifelong love of dancing. The Gladys of old had a light in her eyes, a future in her smile, and can make you laugh when nobody else could, remembered Annie Presley, the wife of Sales Presley, a first cousin to Elvis's father, Vernon. That Gladys vanished once Elvis became famous. But one thing remained a constant. Gladys had always been so entwined with her son that it was hard to know where she left off and he began, even for the two of them. It came both from circumstances beyond their control and from a need that was so great as to be encoded in their DNA. She was born April 25th, 1912, in rural Pontotoc County, Mississippi, the daughter of Robert Lee Smith and Octavia Luvinia Mansell Smith. Gladys's mother was known by the name of Lucy and the nickname of Doll for her slim frame, porcelain skin, oval face, and small features. Not uncommon in farming families, the Smith children numbered 8. Gladys's arrival falling after the first 3 girls, Lillian, Lavelle, and Rusa, and before Travis, Tracy, Cladius, and John. A 9th child did not survive. Her parents romantically gave Gladys the middle name of Love. At 2 years old, Tracy, who was already mentally impaired, contracted whooping cough and lost his hearing. But the real invalid of the family was Doll, Gladys's mother, who had been diagnosed with tuberculosis as a child. Doll, everyone knew, was a relentless flirt. Having been babied by her parents for her affliction and her birth order, she was the youngest of seven, expected the same from everyone around her. When she finally chose to marry at age 27, she picked a younger mate, her first cousin, Bob, a handsome man with dark, deep-set eyes that attested to his mix of Scottish and Indian ancestry through the marriage of William Mansell and Mourning Dove White, a full-blooded Cherokee. White Mansell, the son of John Mansell and grandson of William Mansell, was an Alabaman who moved to Northwest. Excuse me, hold on a minute. I messed that up. White Mansell, the son of John Mansell and grandson of William Mansell, was an Alabama man who moved to Northeast Mississippi at 18 to homestead there in 1870. Marking an X for his signature, he married Martha Tackett, whose mother, Nancy J. Bourdine Tackett, was Jewish. Among their children, Doll, Gladys's mother. Since by Jewish orthodoxy, the mother continues the heritage of Jewish descent, Gladys was technically Jewish by blood. Like many Southern broods, the Smith family was strongly matriarchal. Doll's illness rarely allowed her to leave her bed, but she ruled the family with her sickness. Her feelings of entitlement allowed her to keep a comb and mirror hidden beneath her pillow, while her children slept together on the floor on a mattress padded with crabgrass, held their flimsy shoes together with metal rings culled from the snouts of slaughtered hogs, and fashioned toothbrushes from the branch of a black gum tree. When the Smiths moved, they often did, dotting the communities around Tupelo and Lee County, she would be carefully carried on a trailer in a sabine position, like a princess artifact in a traveling exhibit. As Elvis's biographer and psychologist Peter O. Whitmer wrote in The Inner Elvis, her husband Bob, desperate to scratch out a living from a land where poverty was the norm, demonstrated no love of farming, especially tenant farming, by which he fed his family. He also relied on handouts. Martise Finley Collins remembered her mother, Bertie, would say to the Smith children, bring a bucket, and then she'd put the leftovers in it for the Smith children to eat. Years later, once Elvis became famous, the press labeled the whole Presley clan as white trash. The Smiths still bristle at the term, even though rumor had it that Bob provided the extras Doll wanted from a less respectable trade. Just because you're poor doesn't mean you're white trash, even if you are a sharecropper, insisted Billy Smith, Gladys's nephew, through her brother Travis, a hard drinker with a violent streak for fighting. I guess you couldn't be the son of a bootlegger and not drink, right? Because that's what my granddaddy Robert was, a bootlegger, even though he farmed too. It was just Bob who catered to Doll, but her children too it was. Though Lillian, somewhat Gladys's rival, reported her sister to always be lazy as a hog, shrecking her housework, she could rise to the occasion. By her teenage years, Gladys was industrious, making her own clothes on her friend Vera Turner's sewing machine when she wasn't taking care of her mother or the crops. The harsh reality of life in Tupelo, the year Gladys was born, the town had only one short expanse of sidewalk and no paved streets, let alone electricity, made death, religion, and sheer survival in unstable times the central themes of existence back then. The late Janelle McComb, a lifelong Tupelo resident, remembered the kinds of tenants that helped most folks cope. Old Dr. William Robert Hunt, who delivered Elvis, was my Sunday school teacher, and he was one of my granddaddy's best friends. When I was a little girl, he told me one day that I was going to go to heaven and that I would walk upon streets of gold and have a mansion. I walked a dirt path, so I couldn't imagine that. My granddaddy ran a grocery store, so I walked in there and I said, "Granddaddy, Dr. Hunt says that when I die, I'm going to go to heaven and I'll have a mansion." Then I looked up and said, "But Granddaddy, how am I going to get there?" He closed the store and he walked outside with me. There was a china berry tree in the yard and he put my hand on it and he said, "My child, the timber you send up is what your mansion will be made of. Don't ever send up bad timber." That stayed with me all the days of my life. Still, what got most people through the day today was the rural code of solidarity. This tiny, impoverished community somehow survived by mutually sharing good fortune. The late Elaine Dundy, author of Elvis and Gladys, said in 2004, the one existing home-owned Kodak became the communal camera, as did the few radios on the street. If a few folks at the idea, they hit it well and maintained their standing. By practicing the art of good manners with almost ritualized politeness and having an attitude of optimism is spite of everything. Dave Irwin, his son Lynn, and wife Lily May ran a general store in East Tupelo. And remember that though the Smiths might have been poor, they still found money to buy things, especially after Bob got a loan from the bank and moved the family to a untintinized farm and 30 acres and a house of hedge roses growing around the front door. To Lynn, it seemed like the promised land to him. Gladys, particularly, held her head high. She looked nice, showed off her new homemade dresses, kept her clothes clean, and seemed to come into the more 60 times a day, often in the company of her younger sister, Cletus. First, it might be a box of snuff to keep hunger at bay. Then next trip, maybe a rope of licorice or a soda. Or some visits to the bottle of Grove's Chill Tonic for Doll. And then perhaps some peppermint sticks. By all accounts, Gladys was a lively, passionate young woman who hoped to make a good impression and be accepted by others. She loved to buck dance for the neighbors on Saturday night and dreamed of being either a singer like Mississippi's own radio star Jimmy Rogers or an actress like Clara Bow, whose new talking pictures Gladys watched on a makeshift movie screen on the back of a flatbed truck. But for all her gaiety, her air could flare like a firestorm, and no one wanted her wrath. Nobody wanted her temper. Gladys had inherited not only her father's deep-set eyes, but also his irritability. "Everybody in that family was scared of Gladys and her temper," says Lamar Fike, a member of Elvis's entourage, the Memphis Mafia, who came to know Gladys very well. "She ran all those kids, even her eldest sister Lillianne. Everybody knew not to mess with Gladys much, with a couple of exceptions. The Smith family was just wilder than goats. By God, they were tough, tougher even than the Presleys, and they were violent, very violent people." Coupled with her muscular build, her big, wide shoulders making her resemble a man at times, Gladys' temper made her a force to be reckoned with. Even as a child working on Burke's farm, where sharecroppers, getting a little for themselves and making a whole lot more for someone else, as Billy Smith puts it, were regarded as little more than animals. Aunt Gladys was a strong-willed individual. If you scared her real bad or made her mad, she'd lash out at you. In Tupelo, they still talk about when she was sharecropping with her family. The guy who owned the farm came by on a horse with his high-topped leather boots and a whip, and he jumped on her father and her sisters with it. Gladys was only 10 or maybe 11 years old, but she whipped a plowshare off, took the point, and hit him in the head with it. Damn near killed him. Still, Gladys had her vulnerabilities, most of them emotional, though she attended religious services, worshiping at the Church of God and prophecy. Gladys held to primitive superstitions, and not even her faith could completely quell the anxiety and impulsivity that plagued her from the time she was a small child. In Lillianne's view, the young Gladys was very highly strung, very nervous. She was frightened by all kinds of things, by thunderstorms and wind. She was also hearing noises outside at night and imagined there was someone in the bushes. In time, her uneasiness with life would escalate to full-blown phobias. Once she moved to East Tupelo, which sat across Town Creek from the more prosperous Tupelo proper, she had all the bushes around her house cut down. A terrible sight. Dark things were moving in them, she said. Her anxieties came and went without warning. She seemed better with the promise of social outlets when she had something to look forward to, something that would take her mind off the dreariness of existing hand to mouth. And one of the things that most stirred her imagination was the opposite sex. As a young child, Gladys seemed scared of boys. Her sister Lillianne recalled that the first time a boy asked if he could walk her home from school, Gladys took off her shoes and she ran all the way home. When he caught up to her, he walked way on one side of the road and she ran on the other. Such an extreme reaction may have been in response to her parents' teaching, as her father forged a rigid code of courtship, ruling that boys who come calling on his daughters go no further than holding hands. Kissing was strictly forbidden, and it eventually led to other things. By her late teen years, Gladys was well over her fear of boys, and now it was she who chased them years later. Pid Harris, who dated her in her youth, reported she was fast and liked to play, which of course was a scandal. He remembered her fighting with another girl, the two of them slapping and hitting each other. We had to pull them off of each other. Eventually, it was evidently over another man. But one by one, her older sisters were leaving home to marry. And now Gladys felt the pressure. Her impulse, coupled with her desire to escape the opposition of toiling the fields and caring for her mother and younger siblings, led her to elope with a young farmer when she was in her late teens. Her embarrassment knew no bounds, but when she learned the man was married, in 2 days' time, she was back, morbidly ashamed and heartbroken. Gladys' emotional state grew more fragile in 1931 with the tragic and sudden death of her father from pneumonia. The family was stunned with disbelief. Dahl had always been the sickly one, and so unprepared, they had to borrow a winding sheet from Miss Irwin to get from the general store to wrap the body for placement in an unmarked grave in Spring Hill Cemetery of her father. But rather than stepping up and taking charge, 19-year-old Gladys seemed to crumble. Coming so soon after her failed elopement, the loss of her father was a double blow. Bob Smith had been the one stable man in her life. Guys, hold on a minute. I'm going to talk to Miss Sue, Miss Rhonda, Miss Ann for a minute. Hold on. Did I hear this correctly, Miss Rhonda? Because you read this. Okay. So she goes and gets eloped with someone and to find out he was already married?
That's what it says.
So if they eloped and he was already married, that means that her wedding night was not with Vernon, was with this first guy, baby.
Well, yeah, I thought about that too. I've wondered about that.
And if her heart is broken, then maybe she gave her full self to this guy and on her wedding night, and then find out the next day he's already married. What a scandal that would be. Oh, my goodness.
I know.
At 19 years old.
I know. I wonder the same thing, you know, but I wonder, can we take this for the gospel truth? I mean.
Well, she did do a lot of, she did go to Tupelo and she did speak to all these people who knew these people and went to the library and looked up all the field data and the titles to land and things like that. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, wouldn't think that if the guy was already married, was there a record of her marrying this guy?
There would be a record at the courthouse if she married this guy, but it depends on if the guy first got married in Mississippi or he could have got married in another state. You see what I'm saying? There's a lot of people. You didn't use Social Security numbers back then. You didn't have what we have now to track us. So, you know.
Right.
He could say he was John Smith, but really be Randy something or other. You know, you could fake your name if you wanted to back then.
Right, exactly. So it could have all been, you know, a farce to begin with. So poor Gladys.
So she thought she was getting out. Come to find out, she married a married man.
Yeah, that happened.
Oh, so and also with the records that Miss Elena found, come to find out that Gladys's mama doll married her first cousin Robert. First cousins, which happened a lot in the South, by the way, guys. It really did. It's not really good for genetics to do that, though. It can make a lot of health problems later on, anyway. But it's a practice that happened a lot.
Right. And obviously, Gladys did have a lot of health problems. She passed away very young.
Yes. So. And that could have another instance. I mean, I want to know how many surviving kids were left. You know, it makes you wonder.
It does make you wonder.
Because she had 8 children, Doll did, and Gladys was like the middle child, perhaps. And she had 8 others. And it kind of makes you wonder, out of all the 8 children that Doll and Robert had, how many died young, how many had medical problems. Because that's what happens when first cousins marry.
Oh, yeah. Messes with the biology.
Yes, but back then in the South, they didn't know such thing. They didn't read nothing about no Darwinism. They had no idea. They didn't know.
I mean, if you look back at my family tree, I'm sure the same exact thing happened, you know, so.
Well, they thought marrying your cousins and people that were close to you in blood made your blood stronger, but they didn't know what they were talking about. They were ignorant on that. It was complete opposite. You marry your family, you're going to have bad blood. You're not supposed to marry your relatives, but we didn't know that until way later on. So a lot of people did this. I'm glad Gladys didn't marry her cousin. We're glad about that. But this is a practice that happened a lot. And if you go into the 1930s, which this is where we're reading at, she lost her daddy. Well, she finds out her husband's married, so she has to leave him. She comes back home in defeat because she was married, but it failed. And then she lost her father, and now her mother is the only one alive. And they all thought she would die first from tuberculosis. Come to find out her father died of pneumonia because, you know, God just takes them when he needs them. You know, you can't really plan that. But seems to me that a lot of her problems come from that part of her life. And I didn't know she was also the one that also liked to dip snuff. I know that Minnie Mae loved her snuff, but I didn't know Gladys loved her snuff too.
Yep, a lot of women did that back then. My great grandmother did. So, and I remember it.
And drinking beer from a paper bag. You know what I'm saying?
From
this
a paper
Gladys.
Bag.
I think I could have gotten along with this woman, man, let me tell you. And it sounds to me she has a temper quite like how I do, man. It's like you get real mad at first, like very, very mad, and it takes a little while, but you calm down. But the first reaction is just mad. You're just mad. Dig of it. And then kind of cool off after that. You know, Elvis took after her in that aspect too. Always quick to anger, but it took him a little while, but he would always plateau back to a better mood after after the madness moved away. So,
right. I'm the same way. I'll blow up and then I get over it. So
do I. I'm always first to anger. And I think it's funny that she threw a hot scolding pan of beans on Vernon. Ouch. That hurt. Granted, there have been times I've been wanting to take a frying pan and hit Charles over the head with it, but of course I don't want to go to jail. But that's funny.
Don't do it with an iron skillet.
Don't do it. I might just kill him. Oh, Lord, don't want to do that. I think I'll just go buy a rubber one, a fake rubber one, and hit him over the head with that. Just the thought of it. Like, bang.
Yeah, just stay away from the iron skillet.
Yeah, but goodness sakes. Okay, well, I just wanted to see if that is what I read right about her being, about her eloping with this man that was already married. So she was married once to a man who was already married before she married Vernon.
Very for 2 days.
For two days.
Two days.
But there's a lot of things that can happen in 2 days, okay, guys? There's a lot of things that can happen in 2 days, okay? A lot.
Well,
you can find out what sex is in 2 days.
I just want to know if it's...
You can find out what sex is in 2 minutes. I mean, seriously. 2 days. But she was embarrassed to go back home. I could see that. A small town, and you go home in defeat because your husband was already married to another woman. I can imagine the embarrassment. You know, small towns talk a lot, guys. I'm from one.
Oh, that's true.
So, wow. Okay, I'm going to play a quick song, and I'm going to get back to this because this is pretty good. I like how they're talking about Gladys. I really do. Let's see. I'm going to do a real short one, guys. This is Find Out What's Happening.
Baby, you know me well. You know me what I say. Before I say farewell, I'll give you just another day. You better find out what's happening. Find out what's happening before long. What you gonna do? You better make up your mind. It all depends on you. I'm leaving you behind. You better find out what's happening. Find out what's happening before long. If you don't find out what's happening, you're gonna find out that I'm gone now.
Annette, that our special guy is not going to like them writing about his mama Gladys, but you have to understand a lot of this stuff is also in the book Elvis and Gladys by Elaine Dundy, these ladies did their homework. There's nothing bad. We all knew that Gladys was a drinker, and she was mostly a closet drinker. She didn't like to show it. We all knew that she had a temper. We all knew that, but we always wanted to know what her character was. What kind of a lady was she? What kind of lady raised Elvis Presley? And I don't think there's anything bad about this, because this is showing pure character. This is showing her as a human being, that she is not perfect. None of us are perfect. You know, those without sin cast the first stone. I'm not casting one stone. I'm reading this, and I'm actually enjoying it, that this book is showing that she had humanity, humility, and character. A lot of people overcome their childhood in order to become the adults that they become in life. And this is telling me right here that everything that happened to her is based upon how she was raised, who raised her father, her mother, the family that she was in. And I don't see how this is anything bad at all, you know? So, I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion, but so far I'm not disappointed with reading this about Gladys. I can see that this shows her character. It's also showing humility and her humanity. She was not the Lady Madonna giving birth to this beautiful son of God type thing. No, this was a woman that was Elvis Presley's mother. And before Elvis Presley was famous, he was just a little boy in Tupelo. Dreams. But his dreams were really just to make his mama happy, because he knew how hard she had to work, because she lived in poverty, and so did he. But I don't see how this is bad at all, and I'm hoping our special guy can enlighten us a little bit when he gives us his opinion. But this shows me her character, and this makes me realize how strong she really was as a woman, not just a human being, but a strong woman who was Elvis's mom, who was raising a little man who she adored and whose little man got famous, if you know what I'm saying. But I'm appreciating this so far. So don't judge the book yet, guys. I'm going to keep reading a little bit. Gladys's father's death immeasurably increased Gladys's responsibility with her mother, her three younger brothers, and 12-year-old sister. But try as they might, they could not bring in the crops, and the family's sudden reversal of fortune meant that they would lose the new house and farm that they had. Worse, the family would be split up, with Dahl going to live with LaVale and her husband, Ed. Gladys, feeling responsible for the rest of the family, would have to find a full-time job in a town that offered little employment outside of the cotton mill and the textile plant. In the weeks that followed, Gladys fell into a complete and total collapse. At first, she seemed to revert to the lethargy that had so annoyed Lillian when Gladys was an adolescent. But then she began displaying the classic symptoms of what psychologists call conversion hysteria, in which grief becomes manifested in physical ailments. Her grief made her body change and she got sick. A friend remembered she became so anxious that she could not walk. Gladys got herself into such a state that her legs would start shaking every time she was in the house. Finally, she took to the safety of her bed, unable to move without the help of others, replicating the state that her mother had manifested for decades. Conversion hysteria acts to block the mental pain from conscious awareness and also provides the benefit of allowing its victims to avoid unwanted responsibilities, wrote psychologist Whitmore. In short, Gladys, overburdened with grief and unable to deal with reality, infantilized herself. 10 years later, in the winter of 1941, she had a similar reaction to another tragedy. This time, conversion hysteria rendered her mute. Annie Presley, Gladys's cousin and neighbor, heard a knock and opened the door to find Gladys in such a high state of anxiety that she could not move. She just stood there saying nothing. Tears were streaming down her cheeks. She was wringing her hands over and over again. It was only from a neighbor that Annie learned that Gladys's older sister, Rethra Smith Lloyd, had died a terrible death. Back in them days, we had wood stoves, and she went to build a fire in the stove to cook supper and thought she had got all the sparks out of the one before. She poured a little coal oil in it, and it flamed up and caught her on fire, and it burned her to death. Rethra lingered a few agonizing hours before expiring. In both instances, the only thing that freed Gladys from psychological paralysis and restored her to normalcy was her religious faith in God, particularly after she began participating in Pentecostal services at the tiny Assembly of God Church in the economically deprived East Tupelo, sharply divided from Tupelo by Levee and the cotton fields. There, in a tent pitched in a neighborhood lot, some 30 worshipers gathered each Sunday to pray, sing, and feel the Spirit take hold way down inside of them. Later, they moved to an old building up on the highway. Annie Presley termed it a tabernacle, in a couple of sides. Didn't even have a front, new pews and chairs, just things set up with long planks around them. They call them benches. The congregation also met in an old movie house, ironic since the Assembly of God frowned on picture shows, if not music. In all of our church services, music and singing were very meaningful parts, recalled Reverend Frank W. Smith, who became pastor of the church about 10 years later. We would always begin our services with congregational singing, not loud singing, but worshiping singing. We had a song leader, and everybody would join in and sing along together. Sometimes there would be no worshipful expressions during this part of the service, just singing. As in other Pentecostal churches, the Assembly of God revered speaking in tongues as evidence that the Holy Spirit talked through the parishioners. Both the speakers and the interpreters of the sounds, variously called the barks and the jerks and the holy laugh, were held in the highest esteem. 4 months after the horrific trauma of Rethra's death, Gladys attended yet another tragedy and demonstrated previously unseen emotional strength. Annie's third baby, Barbara Sue, delivered at home, died 8 hours after birth from asphyxiation from too much mucus in her lungs. Gladys was in and out all day, but she had been there from about 5 o'clock in that evening because the baby was struggling pretty bad. We called Dr. Robert about 3 times and he wouldn't come. He wouldn't come. By the time he got there, the baby was dead. Gladys was the one that took the baby out of my bed and put it over on another bed when she died. She stayed right with me the whole time. Annie was only 19, was too weak and distraught to go to the graveyard, so Gladys stayed with her then too, while everybody else went. Your belief in God will get you through, Gladys told the devastating mother over and over again. Annie, look to God. Oh my goodness, Miss Rhonda and Ann, I love that. Look to God. Look to God. So her belief in God and going into the Assembly of God Church, into the Pentecostal part of it, having a community church to go to helped her in her hour of needs, you know, like her grief from her father, the grief of losing her sister, Rethra, who burned alive. Oh, my gosh. And the grief of Annie's baby that died. Oh.
This is the beginning of her feeling. Of her feeling the way she did about E2 and was so close to him and so afraid she was going to leave him.
This is actually kind of explaining a lot of what she was feeling towards her only son because of the grief that she had in her past.
And being, you know, overprotective and all of those things that you hear that Gladys was. I mean, I get it. I mean, It would be hard not to be, especially when she gave birth to, they were twins, and she lost one.
And Liz is one of those, too.
Oh, so I'm sure with all that. Her life has been
filled with many deaths.
Mm-hmm. And there's no problem with certain people at that age, in that time frame, to turn to, and they didn't do this in front of people, but turn to drink to help their sorrows. Besides the Lord, mm-hmm. they would closet drink to get over some of their, you know, instabilities and their fears and whatever is ailing them at that time, or just to numb feelings, just to numb them away.
Exactly, to help them cope.
Because you know what, I'll tell you what, how many times do I tell y'all I wish I had a shot of whiskey right now, every day, pretty much,
mm-hmm.
it happens, but it explains a lot, guys. Gladys's faith in a higher power brought her spiritually to God, but also helped her take all these sorrows in her life and be able to cope. I mean,
right.
Not many people have had their mothers bed-stricken from the very beginning. Tuberculosis doesn't even exist now. It doesn't even happen anymore. But when it did happen, it was a guaranteed death sentence.
Yeah.
No matter what, you're going to die. There was no cure. People said there were cures, but they were flukes. There were never cures. You would die. And so, you know, they had to deal with a lot of stuff, plus poverty, plus trying to feed the children. But you know what I'm saying? So Gladys was raised a lot like how she was raising Elvis. They had no money. They weren't even sharecropping during that time. She was working at the textile plant some of the times. She was doing laundry in her home. She was doing everything she could once Vernon got sent to prison to make ends meet to feed her son, because it was just her and him. It was just her and him for 3 years. 3 years. I couldn't imagine being away from my husband for 3 years. She's been through a lot. And I'm telling you, this book is showing me that she has, I don't know, I'm telling you, this shows me her humanity, her humility, and it's her character, what she was like. It's not every day you can kind of read what she was like. You know, people take a picture of her and you can see her face and stuff, and she rarely smiled. I mean, it's like one picture out of 100. She rarely smiled. And now it kind of makes me wonder, there's a lot of reasons why she wasn't smiling.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stress, a lot of, you know, things that she had to deal with that she wasn't telling people what she had to deal with. I'm just liking this part of the book.
She dealt with a lot at an early age.
Yeah.
Very much so. Back then, children had to grow up fast. Back then, mm-hmm. children didn't get to play. Children had to work just like your parents worked. That you worked the field, they worked the field.
A lot of the times, that's the reason that they had so many children, so that they could help them work and bring
exactly.
in the crops and that type of thing, you know.
So yeah, there was a lot of heartache. Mm-hmm. And
well,
there wasn't any birth control. There definitely was no professional help. There was no psychiatrist back then. And if there was, you didn't have the money to go. You know, but I'm glad that she found God and decided to go to church, and that helped her gain inner strength with all these tragedies. Mm-hmm. She needed something. But look to God. Look to God. Amen. I love that. Okay, so read just a little bit more, and then we got to go. I'm going to read just a little tiny bit, okay?
Okay.
But so far, I mean, I'm liking the story of how Gladys was. Gladys's faith in a higher power brought her more than spiritual solve. However, for it was in that East Tupelo church in the spring of 1933 that Gladys Love Smith, who had just turned 21 and operated a sewing machine at the Tupelo Garment Company for $2 a day, first laid eyes on Vernon Elvis Presley. He was blondish, fine-featured, well-mannered around women, and with full lips that curled into an easy sneer. He looked like a backwoods Romeo straight out of a tobacco road. Erskine Caldwell's classic novel of sex violence among the rural poor. They eloped 2 months after they met on June 17, 1933, in Pontotoc County, where Vernon, barely 17 years old, but looking every bit a full-grown man, could pass as one. He borrowed the money for the marriage license, which spelled his name Vernon with an I instead of an E. Either because the clerk made an error or because Vernon, who was only throughout his life, knew no better how to spell it. Both he and his bride lied about their ages. Vernon, 17. Gladys, 21. Vernon adding 5 years for 22. And Gladys subtracting 2 for 19. In a photograph taken of them about that time, they can hardly conceal their hunger for each other, their heads pressed together, Gladys snuggled up to him from behind, her arm wrapped around his shoulder. Yet it was not precisely love at first sight. Initially, Gladys dated Vernon while her younger sister, Cletus, went with Vernon. Gladys didn't like my attitude much, Vester said years later. I was too wild in those days. So Gladys quit seeing me, and we quit seeing the Smith girls for a while. But soon it was a foursome again, as Cletus married Vester after Gladys wed Vernon. Two brothers marrying two sisters. To further entangle the family tree, rooted in the first cousin union of Bob and Dole Smith, Travis and John Smith, Gladys's brothers, also married sisters. So their kids and my brother Bobby and we were double first cousins, explained Billy Smith. You've got a double first cousins on the Presley side too. So I'm going to quit there, guys. But see, I'm trying to tell you all, back in the day, that's what happened a lot, especially in rural southern states, marrying your cousin, marrying sisters, brothers marrying sisters, not brothers and sisters, but, you know, sisters from like across the road marrying brothers from across the road. They're not related to each other, but they marry each other, you know, like sister-in-law type thing, brother-in-law type thing, or cousins marrying cousins. That happened a lot too. It doesn't really happen too much now because they kind of discourage it as much as possible, but it happened back in the day more often than not. So, but I mean, thank you, for hearing me out tonight and listening to part of the story of Gladys, guys. I appreciated it. I hope you guys
enjoyed
it. I liked it.
Oh, yeah, I think it was very interesting to know more about her. Now we know a lot more.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff that's in this book, Elena Nash told me that a lot of the stuff on Gladys in this book got from Elaine Dundy, Elvis and Gladys book, where Elaine Dundy got it from Tupelo doing her research and talking to the people of Tupelo.
Okay.
Both these ladies did do the family research, and they also talked to Billy Smith, and Billy Smith is Elvis's cousin now. And he would know about the Smith family very much so. In fact, Billy Smith and Danny Smith from the Memphis Mafia Kid, they still talk about the Smith family a lot from Tupelo on their YouTube channel. So, but it helps me open my mind up about Gladys, you know, like kind of walk in her shoes just a little bit, because she went through an awful lot really young, and that defined her. That defined her. That made her the person that she was, who raised Elvis Presley. So, but I can't wait to read more on Wednesday for you guys. I can't wait. We'll find out some more, okay?
Oh, yeah, this is interesting.
And we get to find out what our special guy thinks, but I don't think he's going to mind. It's not like stuff he doesn't already know about his mama. He knows his mama very well, so we'll see if it was accurate or not, but I don't think he's going to get too angry about it. I really don't. I find it very enlightening, very enlightening.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
In fact, it made me feel a little bit more closer than Gladys than I do with Elvis. It's kind of strange. I guess women kind of do like to stick together. I kind of understand her a little bit more than I did before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah. She went through a lot. She's been at a very young age, like you said. And
yeah.
I'm sure that's what
and she had a lot of loss. She had a lot of loss. So I can imagine that's why she was very overprotective, because she knew what loss was, and she already lost in her family, and then she lost her baby, Jesse. So I can imagine how she was with Elvis. I know I can't have any more kids. Wade's my only. So it's like, you mess with my son, you mess with me. You'll have a problem with me. But
that's exactly right.
I feel like I know her more now than I did before. It was really enlightening, and I appreciate how Elena Nash wanted to make her more human, because people think of her like a Madonna. You know what I'm saying? Like, like people like to make her so perfect because she was Elvis's mom. The thing is, that's not the point. The point is, she was a woman who had lots of ideas and thoughts and tragedies and things happened into her life that make her who she was, that defined who she was. And it gives her a little bit of humility as well, because we all are humans and we all have humility. That's part of us being human. Life is not perfect. Life gets in the way, guys. It's not perfect. But anyways, I can't wait to read more for you guys on Wednesday, okay? And I'm going to have to go, but thank you so much for listening, what you could listen to tonight. And I'll be with you guys next Wednesday, okay?
Okay. Look forward to it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you, Sean.
You're very welcome, guys. I love you so much. TCB, TLC on the side, because that's where I am tonight. And God bless y'all, and I will talk to y'all on the other side.
Yesterday has slipped away, and the sun is welcoming the evening shadows of a perfect day. And the next step is love. The next step is love. We walk barefoot through the misty meadows, laughing at each other in the rain. Made some faces at some people in the park and didn't bother to explain. Fun, fun, look at us run, going nowhere special really fast. But we've yet to taste the icing on the cake that we've been baking with the past. And the next step is love. So what are we waiting for? The next step is love. Girl, it's for sure. Yesterday has slipped away, and the sun is welcoming the evening shadows of a perfect day. And the next step is love. Next step is love. Love will be a place to run to from the world they've willed to you and me. We'll be closer than we've ever been, though looking back it's so hard to believe. We're bringing on in the best we've picked up on the way to now. Changes are coming, but together we can make it through somehow. 'Cause the next step is love. So what are we waiting for? Well, the next step is love. Yesterday has slipped away, the sun is welcoming the evening shadows of a perfect day. And the next step is love. The next step is love.